From the Native American Cultural Center and the Billings Center for the American West at Stanford University, this is Portraits of a Pandemic.
Hi, welcome to our second episode. This is Aja speaking to you from the lands of the Mwakmalone people in Menlo Park, California. This is also the first episode about Seattle. And on this side of the podcast, we're going to look at the personal lives of Natives and how they're adapting during the pandemic. I think that a lot of times when we talk about race and equity and health, it's really easy to lose focus. They're super nebulous and everybody has their own opinions, and they're just really incredibly complicated subjects, which I say as somebody who just spent like most of my undergraduate career studying this kind of stuff. It's overwhelming and exhausting sometimes, especially for BIPOC people. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but when the protests began this summer, there was of course a feeling of excitement and invigoration, as it finally felt like people were quote-unquote waking up to the gross amounts of racial injustice that have been a huge part of our American history and that are still happening. But it also reminded me of my own people and how exhausting it is to fight not for a specific policy, nor for an election or a party preference, but just for people to recognize that my people are still here and that our struggle isn't over. And that Black Lives Matter and everything people were fighting for over the summer, including myself, it's not that crazy. And more so that while Native people will lead our own fight and protect what is sacred to us, we can't do it alone. We need you to care too. Not just about Native people in America, but about making all our planet better. For our people, for your people, and for the earth that is sacred. We want to do our part and show you who Native people are, and how our history cannot help but inform our present. This is so evident in the subject of health. Health isn't just about our physical condition, it's about the condition of our lives. How we are mentally, how we perceive the world, how we imagine ourselves in it, and how we interact with our society's view of us and the groups we're affiliated with. Here, when we ask our interviewees about health, we're asking them how they are, and how they're maintaining their health throughout this pandemic. As a lot of us have learned during the pandemic, it's not just our physical health we have to maintain. We exist far beyond our bodies, and we carry with us the memories and trauma of ourselves and our relations. But to be fair, I need to justify why we've come to these conclusions at Portraits of a Pandemic. And we're gonna spend the rest of our time in Seattle asking how nativeness affects and experiences health. Now, why are we in Seattle? Well, in the summer of 2019, I had the opportunity to intern at the Chief Seattle Club in Seattle, Washington. Chief Seattle Club is a day center for Natives. They service Natives at all rungs of the tax bracket because they are more of a community center. But a large portion of the club members are struggling with chronic houselessness and addiction. They help members access government services like case management and assistance with document acquisition. That's like getting a birth certificate or a new social security card. But they also provide culturally specific substance recovery programs and spiritual healing services in the form of art practice and spiritual gatherings. And these members, who are often deeply disadvantaged, have a community and a home there. But it is completely based on the idea of a physical place of gathering, something that's not possible during the pandemic. So we wanted to know how members and employees are getting along. What are some of the most disadvantaged people and the people who work for them doing now that we can't be together? Now that their health is at risk, and now that their community must weather another storm. Over the course of 4 episodes, we're going to learn about nativeness and how we adapt with it. This episode is about Lance Thompson, a member of Chief Seattle Club, but we're going to inform his story by talking to Matt Snipp as he explains the complicated relationship between Natives on the reservation and Natives in the city. And we're also going to inform Lance's story by talking about nativeness and healthcare. So let's get started. Hi, Lance.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm good. I'm super excited about our interview. Let's get started.
I met Lance through my contacts at Chief Seattle Club. He didn't interact with the club much when I was there, but Lance and I share something really special. We are from the same tribe, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes of northwestern Montana. This was particularly exciting for me because there just aren't many of us out there, and even less living in cities. So I was stoked because I didn't even know this before the interview. Lance and I talked for a while about the tribe and particularly our powwow, the Arlie celebration. Do you go to powwow a lot?
our celebration is usually, you know, around July the 4th. And we went to the powwow for a year. I took in my cousin's food booth there. My daughter was a dancing cell dancer since she was a little girl. You know, she started dancing when she was two. A lot of the times I could set up my schedule because I had my own business and I could schedule jobs around certain powwows because we danced. And some years we hit 28 powwows.
Oh, wow. Now, Lance, can you tell us, like, why is the res so special to you?
Same thing with Montana. I think it's like Shangri-La. You come over the mountains and you see the Mission Valley. It's just breathtaking. There's three big waterfalls that fall down the mountainside that you can see. It's just a little town, 850 people in it. It's a wonderful place. Everybody knows who you are and your children's names. There's no real strangers. They're either related to you or you know them. And that's a pretty nice thing. Sometimes it gets a little tiring, but you have to deal with conflict better and have to deal with it because you see these people every day, the stores or the gas station, because there's one gas station, there's one grocery store, one hardware store. If you have a problem or a conflict with somebody, then you have to work it out because you have to live in the same town, which is in the city, they don't. So you don't get in arguments, you don't yell, stuff like, you know, and you, everybody knows everybody. So if somebody sees you doing something wrong, then they'll tell your mother or father or your grandmother.
But despite Shangri-La, Lance left.
We're in Seattle. I've been here for like 3 years, 3.5 years. And I don't have no real relationships or friendships with people here. Everybody's busy trying to get to where they're going and what they're doing. And my children are about the same way too. I'm in a city of, you know, 800,000-900,000 people, and you're still alone. And now with the pandemic, you're really alone because you don't even get to see those people.
This story is one that so many Native people will recognize, and it's an important part of contemporary Native identity. Most people think of reservations when they think about Natives, but there are so many Natives living in urban areas, and they have been living in urban areas for a long time. But when did they leave the reservation? Well, we're going to chat with Matt for a sec and talk about this. So by the 20th century, the reservation system was largely set up and many Natives still lived on their reserved land. But the U.S. government ended up creating a bunch of relocation programs for Natives. Now, a relocation program sounds either great or like really sketchy. But how did it work out, Matt?
So, you know, you'd move, people would sign up for relocation. They'd get to move to, you know, Seattle or Oakland or wherever. They'd spend 6 months or a year there and discover they couldn't find a job, and then they'd move back home.
So were these programs a detriment to the reservations?
In some ways, it was a detriment. It was a detriment in the sense that it was like a brain drain. Who had work experience, were able to hold a job, had skills, and moved them to cities. But it also had another group that they moved, which were people who did not have much education, who didn't have much experience, and tried to bring them to cities to give them, you know, job skills. I mean, the stereotype is a mechanic. You always wonder why there's a stereotype of Indian auto mechanics. Well, it's because a lot of them ended up being trained as mechanics, and that's where you saw a lot of Native people working. But for this group that didn't have much education, didn't have much in the way of job experience, what it did was that it took them from being poor and uneducated, unemployed persons on the reservation and moved them into cities and turned them into poor, uneducated persons who were unemployed in cities. And not surprisingly, one of the criticisms of the relocation programs was that it became a revolving door.
So big reason to leave. Money. There just wasn't a lot of it on the reservation. And it's really difficult to build a robust economy with much of the land Native people were given. And if we think back to the last episode, remember Matt told us that the reservations are the lands that were reserved by the U.S. That means they got to choose which lands those were. And while the history of tribal sovereignty is very case to case, overall, the chosen pieces of land were often devoid of natural resources, or at least the ones they could access at the time, and super far away from other cities. For instance, though my tribe has a lot of natural resources that we've benefited from immensely, the first town on the road in our tribe is 26 miles away from the next city, which is Missoula, Montana. Now, that's not a lot when you have a car, but it's super far if you're living in the 20th century or the 19th century, before anybody would go out there and you're trying to form a tribal government and a tribal economy in a new city that was formed by an enemy government that you now have to trade with. Just doesn't sound like a good mix, you know? But following all those relocation programs, I want to know, where did the government go from there? Matt, when did relocation stop and what went on after?
Well, I think it really began in the mid-1970s during Jimmy Carter's administration when they started cutting on federal social programs. And the tribes realized that they could not depend on the generosity and largesse of the federal government in order to provide the kind of community and services and the kind of, and build the kind of community that they wanted to build. And so they started thinking seriously about economic development as a strategy for building resources to do what they needed to do. And then when the Reagan administration came along, I mean, that was a massive cut in assistance to the tribes. And that made this sort of move to economic self-sufficiency even more urgent.
This is part of a long pattern of the federal government swinging back and forth from trying to include Native people in America, sometimes and usually via assimilation, to outright rejecting their needs and slashing funding. This has happened a lot. So this story that you're hearing of Lance, it's just one of many. So Lance, what brought you to Seattle?
I had a drywall business with up to 11 employees and pretty successful drywall business out of San Ignatius. I hired as many natives as I could back home and taught them a trade where they could make real good money on a economically depressed reservation and hold their head up high and have things to show their children. I did this, you know. I you know, I built this, I did this. And in 2008, 2009, the economy crashed. And so I lost my business.
Lance also lost his home.
Me and my family come over here to Seattle to kind of wait out the recession. And to come back over here and get jobs over here because there wasn't nothing in Montana. And during that time, we were here for 4 years. And me and my wife, we got a divorce. It was too much, just too hard. So it really, it tore us apart because I wasn't able to find a job. I always had more jobs than I could handle.
Mm-hmm.
And the respect of all my colleagues and everybody that I've done things for. And then come over here to Seattle, and it was just a big change. Going from being the best that there was in with the drywall in Montana to being a janitor over here, that was really tough on me.
Wow, have you ever experienced houselessness in the city?
I've been homeless here. Yes, when I got here from Montana, I was homeless and sleeping in parks, and I went to a couple of the shelters that they had here. I would rather sleep in a park in the rain than those shelters seem like pretty unsafe, scary places to be.
Lance ended up going back and forth between home and Seattle after he and his wife broke up.
But I got cancer in the bones of my shoulder, and that's why I'm back over here. I've got to be around my children, but my heart is still back home on the reservation. That's where my church is, up in those mountains. My shoulder, they want to do a full replacement because I can't use my left arm anymore. And I have been here in September. It'll be 3 years waiting for my surgery to get scheduled.
Wow.
And it was about to get scheduled, and then the pandemic happened.
So why did you have to wait?
My doctor was at the Seattle Indian Health Board, and we had gotten everything finalized because they wanted me to apply for Social Security disability. I just want to get my shoulder fixed so I can get back to work.
But then the doctor Lance was working with decided to leave his job at Seattle Indian Health Board and become a stay-at-home dad.
And then the next doctor I got wouldn't use any of the old doctor's notes, said he wanted to start at the beginning and go through, see what he thinks about it and that stuff like that, you know?
See, on Lance's insurance, you could only take one test each time you went to the doctor. And those tests expire after 6 months. So after now, we're at nearly the year and a half mark. He's had a bunch of tests that have expired. So now he has to do them again and wait until he can come back again.
I mean, there was a lot of jumping through hoops and things that you had to do to be time-worthy. And there was just no way you could do it. I mean, then they gave me a shot for hepatitis, and so I wouldn't get it. And they didn't tell me that I couldn't have a surgery or be scheduled for a surgery for a year after the lady gave it to me. I did that because I had to take one shot, then one 6 months later, and then one at the year mark. And she told me after that, she said, "Now you can't schedule any surgery for a year because you have the active antibodies in your system." And I said, "I wish you would have told me that before." You know, you gave me the vaccine. So, and then I started over again, and it's pretty frustrating.
Yeah.
When you see your children struggling over here in Seattle, and I can't work, my arm's no good, and the doctor said if I work that, you know, that I could really do some damage, and it's just tough. So I just, and it's almost been 3 years. I mean, I've wasted 3 years of my life, and you only get so many days on this planet. Mm-hmm. And just to sit and not be a functional part of society is really, really hard.
At this point, you might be thinking what I was thinking when I heard this, which is, how the hell does this happen? I mean, he has cancer. Isn't that more important than getting a shot? I mean, how could anybody let this happen? And honestly, when I first thought about this, I was like, how could Lance let this happen? Shouldn't you check? Well, the story reminded me of a different story that I've heard about a woman named Henrietta Lacks. She was a Black woman with cervical cancer in the 1950s, and after she passed, scientists studying molecular biology obtained her cells. And these cells from her, HeLa for her name, went on to help develop the polio vaccine. They were the first cells in space. Without Henrietta Lacks, things like IVF, genomic mapping, cloning, we wouldn't have any of that. We wouldn't be nearly as far without the HeLa cells. But, you know, this rather poetic idea of the immortal cell is also really marred by the fact that those scientists never asked for permission to use the cells, and they were deemed by a judge to be public property simply because Mrs. Lacks was dead. And this thought, of course, led me to think about the Tuskegee study, where almost 400 Black men were purposely not treated for syphilis, which they didn't know, for 40 years. This then, of course, I'm in a, you know, brain black hole now, led me to think about the Family Planning Services and Population Research Act of 1970, which led to the medical sterilization of 25% of Native women, likely more, in 1970. And too many of those sterilizations happen under duress or pressure or just without the patient understanding what sterilization was. I mean, even medical tools we use today, like the spirometer, which measure lung ventilation, have to be race corrected because its core programming assumes that there's a racial difference in lung capacity. So why did I just say all of that? Well, I thought about all this stuff because there's a reason why so many Native people do not trust, do not interact with, and do not know a lot of stuff about Western medicine and health practitioners. And I just told you like four of those reasons. And when you think about those stories, we should think about how many more stories there are that we just don't know, that haven't gotten famous. And we should also think about how fast information travels. How many generations of Native women have shared their experience of sterilization? Information travels like crazy, and it permeates through generations. The thing is, people of color have known that racism exists because we've been telling each other about it for so long. We feel it, and because it does persist, especially in the medical field. I mean, a study in 1999 found that doctors were less likely to refer Black patients than white patients for cancer treatment, even if they were at similar levels of sickness. And 20 years later, a 2019 study found that a popular diagnostic algorithm was less likely to refer Black people than white people. So two studies 20 years apart found basically the same thing about the mistreatment of Black people by the medical community. So with all of this, for lack of better term, messing up that has happened, it's built off of generations of mistreatment. I mean, if you knew your family had historically been treated badly by an institution, would you want to depend on them? strike a good dialogue with them and really learn about their practice? I mean, probably no. I wouldn't. And when I think about all of these stories and just the general history of Native people, I can't help but be suspicious of doctors too sometimes. We didn't have this medicine before first contact. Western medicine was brought to us, but so was colonization and genocide and pandemic. So it's not so strange to me that Native people often don't have a great interest in learning about Western medicine. But I've strayed pretty far from Lance. The point being, when I think about being in his shoes, having a Native doctor at Seattle Indian Health Board, I would have taken the shot too. Because the doctor told me to, and there would be so few doctors I trust, so few that Lance could even access. I wouldn't have thought to learn about the vaccine or figure out if it was okay. The doctor should know. The doctor should tell you. And his treatment of Lance is so disappointing. And what shakes me the most about it is that it has happened to so many people that we don't even know about. And the fact that it's still happening today is ridiculous.
You know, we've had 200 years of depression and anxiety put on us. One of my depression counselors, because, you know, most Natives have depression. You know, our lifestyle, our way of life, the things that we do, are they were taken from us and told not to do things that we did. And so there's challenges in the world today that we've never faced before. Like me, I was an alcoholic. Well, I guess basically I still am, but I don't drink. I quit for 13 and a half years.
So how has the pandemic been for you, Lance?
It's the isolation that's the worst. I can't go to the parks and sit there and talk to the Native friends that I have made. And I can't go to powwow in the Seattle area. There's usually a powwow every weekend within 20, 30 miles with the Muckleshoots, the Tulalip, Arlington, Darrington powwows, Shallop. I mean, this is a Native rich area, but it's just, I like going to the powwow. When I go to a powwow, it takes me back to where I can sit down and just relax. And Natives are smiling and happy and joking. Even if you're having a, you know, you're not doing so good. If you ain't got no money and you ain't got no, you know, everything's, you're homeless, you ain't got nothing. But when you're at a powwow around other Natives, you're laughing and you're joking and you usually get what you need and you have that fellowship.
Lance was injured in December, so he's been home since then. When I interviewed him, he'd been at home for 7 months.
About the time the pandemic hit, you know, we started hearing about it in February. So I haven't really been much able to go outside of my apartment, and besides tearing down the trash or whatever, I haven't seen or been able to interact with my children hardly very much. They are the cornerstone. They're my family, my pressure relief, my endorphin, you know, being around my kids, you know, laughing and joking, just sitting there watching a movie or throwing a ball or, you know, just walking or talking to them. It's relaxing because they're the people that I know. And that I've known for a long time, where the people I've met over here, I haven't. And my family member that passed away in Montana, they're going to rest. She was a nice lady, and haven't been able to say goodbye to her. Being over there and to give my condolences to her children, you know, hugs and things like that. You know, that's still, it's not closed.
You mentioned your daughter was going to University of Washington. Is she still going?
Yes, she's going to. You cannot pass up a four-year scholarship to the University of Washington. She's really a remarkable person. You know, that little fancy shawl dancer from Kane Gangsta, Montana. I mean, she's a remarkable person. She just amazes me. This has been the most horrible trying time in my life. It's kind of like my daughter. She said, why this year? You know, she graduated. This is when she would have graduated from high school, was 2020. Yeah. And they didn't have a ceremony. She didn't get her senior prom, none of that stuff. And being at my age, I have some COPD from hanging sheetrock all those years. And the sheetrock dust getting into my lungs, and I got diabetes and other things. If I get the virus, I probably, it'll be a miracle if I survive it. So I don't normally go outside my apartment because I want to see my daughter get married. I want to see my son get married and things like that, you know? There's still a lot of things that I want to do. So, you know, it's just rough.
Yeah.
But me, I think of my children, I think of Montana, and there's a lot of things to keep your mind going with this racism thing that's going on here and the accountability.
Absolutely.
So keeping my mind working, you know, trying to think of advice and things that I can tell my children that might help them out during this time.
Is there anything else you want to say? Any hopes for what people take away from your episode or anything like that?
Well, what they should take is that we do only have so many days on this planet, and each day that you lose is one you never get back. So if you're not doing what you love to do, then you're wasting days. You know, the things that are free are best, like a hug from your child, or laughing with your friends, or just sitting there watching the water on the beaches. You know, things that I enjoy that I love to do was to watch the waves, you know, come in on Puget Sound while I'm sitting at the park, where I can't do that really right now. So just, we got to remember to change back to the way it was, where, you know, money wasn't the best thing to have. It was friends and family and love and fellowship and friendship and tradition. Those grandmas doing the hair of their grandbabies, teaching them how to make things and have things instead of using their credit cards to buy them. And remember that people, when they go away, you never get them back.
Yeah.
But money goes away. You can always get money all the time, or a new car or a new house. But when a family member passes on, you don't really get to talk to them again. So, you know, cherish the people around you that you love and care about, not the things that you own.
Well, thank you, Lance. I really appreciate you chatting with me today. And I'm so excited for folks to hear your episode. And I really appreciate everything you've done for me.
No, it's good. Thank you for giving me a chance to talk and ramble on. Made my day, and it perked me up. I was happy to assist you in what you're doing, and to say congratulations and another Native person, you know, tackling the challenges of the world and going to college. And, you know, that's really, it's hard when it comes from the Native people to be grounded and to be doing things like that. So proud of you being a Native and being in college. I mean, that's wonderful, because there's so many that don't think they can, you know, and we got to rise. Mm-hmm. We got to build our people up. And that's such a hard thing for people in our, you know, the depression that people have to deal with, and the pride issue. We are a proud people. And that's why when I was, you know, had my business and had a chance to teach Natives, I did. And I've seen them become prouder of themselves and more self-assured and self-esteem and self-respect. And that's what we got to do for our people. I mean, that is the key.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's so important to make sure that Native people are able to access education and all of the public goods that our country has to offer. Well, that is all the questions I had. Lance, thank you so, so, so much for doing this with us. I really appreciate it, and it's been so nice to talk to you.
Okay, you have a nice day. What's the weather like down there? It's raining up here in Seattle.
Oh, it's actually real sunny down here. I'm actually totally going to go outside after this.
All right.
Well, you have a great day, Lance. Thank you so, so, so much.
You too, and it was wonderful talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Aja.
Hey, Hannah. How's it going?
It's going great. I just listened to your recording of Lance, and that was amazing.
Oh,
it was also really intense and really inspiring, and I just absolutely loved hearing his story. And I was wondering, this was a few months ago.
Yeah.
What's Lance doing now?
Well, actually, so I've been in contact with Lance recently. and unfortunately, about a week ago, he was exposed to COVID. He was taking care of a sick older relative, and she had COVID, and so now he has been exposed to it. And of course, I'm very concerned, and he's really concerned, but I will say he has such high spirits, mm-hmm. which is incredible. After he told me, like, he followed up right after by saying that he was upset, but of course he was like just so stoked that Kamala Harris is our vice president and that there's, you know, a woman of color in the office. And I just thought that was incredible for him to leap from, you know, this possible really severe diagnosis to that, because he just really is able to keep in such high spirits. And I do think it's in part because he believes in our heritage so much, and he believes in traditional ways, and they are clearly a mental health factor for him positively, and they really positively impact him. And it's just really incredible to see somebody be in such high spirits in the situations mm-hmm. he's been in the past couple of months, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm really sorry to hear that he's exposed, but I'm glad that he's still, you know, in high spirits and, you know, sees the light at the end of the tunnel during these times.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge reminder how important tradition and traditional practices are to Native people, and how they can be a really helpful tool for also treating them and for treating these historical wounds. I mean, I'm really excited for your episode next week because it's going to kind of be about similar stuff, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, just this week when we're looking at Seattle, Washington, we'll really see that there's a lot of crossover when we're talking about the healthcare system in the U.S. and also where there's the interplay between kind of traditional medicine and the kind of westernized healthcare system that many are familiar with today. So this week, while we discussed kind of lines along mistrust in the healthcare system and also kind of historical losses and historical wounds that have had to do with when the healthcare system has not treated well or has misled people of color in the United States. And as we go into next week, we'll continue to explore and build on these themes, as well as consider really where's the crossover between urban and rural areas and how Natives experience health, how Natives lead healthy lives, and what does that look like during COVID-19?
Definitely. And, you know, for all of you listening, we are so excited to bring you these stories because, of course, each episode does stand alone, but also they're building to a greater picture, to something that's important to share with everybody, which is Nativeness in its state now. And we're so excited for you to hear more. And the next episode will be up soon, and we are so excited for you to hear it. And thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, everybody.